This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. A frantic multi-state blitz of campaigning in marginal seats is kicking off as political leaders race to secure last-minute votes. Labor leader Anthony Albanese and key frontbenchers are targeting 20 coalition-held seats in five states. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is also expected to visit numerous seats, including in Western Australia. Our reporter, David Lipson, joins me now. David, good morning. This blitz, what does that say about the state of play 2 days out from the election?
Good morning, Sabra. As you know, the itinerary matters greatly at this late stage of the campaign, and what it tells us is what's really been clear from the start, that the Prime Minister is under serious threat from Labor. So he's in Tasmania today, where the seats of Bass and Braddon are at risk of falling to Labor. Then, before the Saturday vote, he'll head to Perth. Seats like Pearce, Hasluck and Swan, all coalition-held electorates which are in Labor's sights. Anthony Albanese, meanwhile, is on the attack, barnstorming, as you mentioned, 20 marginal Liberal-held seats in New South Wales and Queensland first, then south to Victoria, South Australia and Tasmania. And Labor has even branded this blitz, calling it a final sprint to a better future, and his media team briefed out that itinerary. So clearly trying to send a message that Labor is on the march. First off, Anthony Albanese will head to Bennelong in Sydney this morning, John Howard's old seat. It has a high Chinese-Australian population, and there's a view amongst some in Labor that the Chinese-Australian vote has shifted somewhat to Labor, which is significant, not just in Bennelong, but also in Reid in Sydney, Chisholm in Melbourne. But look, overall, I guess this is primarily a story of the Prime Minister protecting his turf in a wafer-thin one-seat majority government, Labor targeting a large number of coalition-held seats.
And jobs in the economy will feature pretty heavily today. What are we expecting?
Yes, the jobs numbers are out today. You'll remember a month ago, right near the start of the campaign, we were expecting the jobless rate to dip to a number with a 3 in front of it. It didn't happen then, but it is likely to happen today. And that will play well for the coalition's pitch on jobs, jobs, jobs. And a short time, shortly after those figures come out, we'll get Labor's election costings. That is the price tag for its election promises. Now, we're almost certain they will cost more than the government's promises, but there's already been some attempt by Labor at offsetting those costs. Labor's banking $400 million by dumping the government's regionalisation fund, and another $350 million will be slashed from the community grants program. Both of those programs have come under scrutiny over claims of pork barrelling. The Labor leader, Anthony Albanese, was on ABC News Breakfast this morning.
This government have established a whole range of rorted funds. We all know commuter car parks where there's actually no train station for people to get on. The North Sydney Pool was funded from a regional grants program. This government have used taxpayers' money as if it is money of the Liberal Party and the National Party.
Labor leader Anthony Albanese, and before him, our reporter David Lipson. And coming up on RN Breakfast, Patricia Carvelis interviews Employment Minister Stuart Robert and Deputy Labor leader Richard Miles. Despite all the last-minute campaigning, millions of Australians have already made up their mind. 3.2 million people have walked into a polling booth to cast their vote, as David Sparks reports.
At this pre-polling centre in Bellevue Hill in Sydney's eastern suburbs, there are plenty of signs out front promoting the candidates and about a dozen volunteers handing out how-to-vote cards. And there's no queue to get in and vote.
I'm actually going to be away this weekend, so I thought I would get in quick.
Have you voted early before or first time?
First time.
Was it easy?
Super easy. I was in and out within about 10 minutes.
I do live here and it was easy, and I think it's probably a good thing for them to know early how it's going.
Do you always vote early or is it a new thing for you?
Very new thing. Yeah. I didn't know you could. I knew you could do postal votes, yeah. But yeah.
This is the electorate of Wentworth, where Liberal MP Dave Sharma faces a stiff challenge from Teal independent Allegra Spender.
I've been 100% focused on early polling for the last 2 weeks, and I think that probably around 50% or even more of the electorate will vote early in Wentworth. So I've had a more chance to talk to voters because I've been more around over a long period of time, so I've really enjoyed that.
In this seat, 35% of voters have either already cast their ballot or applied for a postal vote.
Sir, you're voting early today. Why are you voting early?
Because I won't be here on the weekend.
Have you ever voted early before or is it the first time?
It's probably the first time.
So far this election, more than 3.2 million people have already cast their vote in what's known as a pre-poll. Another 2.6 million have applied for a postal vote. Professor Rodney Smith is an early voting expert from the University of Sydney.
At the last election, there was 4.8 million pre-poll votes cast out of an electorate of about 16.4 million voters. This time the overall electorate is bigger and we'd expect a higher proportion of people to pre-poll vote, so it could easily be 6 million voters.
Do we know if any kind of early polling, pre-polling or postal, favours one side or the other?
Well, postal voting has always traditionally been seen as favouring the Liberal and National parties, and that's partly because of the fact that postal votes are cast in the main by older voters who tend to be a little more conservative, and also that the Liberal and National parties actively attempt to garner postal votes. The Labor Party puts less effort into that. Early in-person voting, so pre-poll voting, there's no party advantage there. The major parties overall do equally well in the early in-person votes.
The safe LNP seat of Hinkler in Queensland leads the early voting pack. 40% of people there have pre-polled or applied for a postal vote. The marginal seats of Chisholm in Melbourne, Gilmore on the New South Wales south coast and Longman in southeast Queensland are close behind.
Look, it's very much driven by convenience, and that's the case in around the world. I mean, Australia's not unique in the growth in early voting. It's happening in every or almost every Western democracy. And it is a convenience thing. It's a lifestyle changes. People are out of their local area more often on a Saturday. They might be at work. They might be, enjoying leisure activities or whatever. And the option is there. And it's very hard for legislators and for electoral commissions to kind of resist that.
Professor Rodney Smith from Sydney University, David Sparks reporting there. In this last-minute battle for votes, some Australians feel they've been largely left out. In Melbourne's African community, the issues dominating media coverage have had little or no impact in a campaign that's generated little interest. Social affairs correspondent Norman Hermont reports.
The election is just 2 days away and the campaign has reached a fever pitch. But you wouldn't know that in Footscray, in Melbourne's west. Katinda Dola says the African community here, like many others out of the so-called mainstream, feels disengaged and unwanted.
You're sidelined. You're a minority. Who cares about minority? They're very small. So I feel a lot of people want to be part of this conversation. A lot of people want to be part of the bigger picture, but they feel left out. They're not invited to the table.
Longtime community leader Dr. Berhan Ahmed says the detachment from elections is hardly new. Too many times, commitments to address racism and youth employment have come and gone.
People have had so many promises and nothing comes. People need to build trust on the system. Trust is about delivery. You promise people and you deliver it. If you, give people promises and you don't deliver it, it's not about color of people or whatever people are. People lose interest.
That loss of interest is more pronounced than many would imagine. Abbas Abukar says people will show up to tick the boxes on election day, but some won't have any idea who they're voting for.
The people also, they don't know who they're ticking also. They just go on ticking because they don't give them a fine.
Yes.
Katinda Dola admits after a campaign in which virtually nothing spoke to her concerns, she's flying blind.
I'm actually going to vote today, but I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm just going to go there and try to figure out something because I have no idea what's appealing to me, what's going to be good for me, what's not good for me. I have no clue. And why do I have a clue? I know they're on TV all the time, talking all these things, debates and everything. But it doesn't appeal to anything, to me, my family, my friends, my community. It doesn't talk to us. It's not us.
There are lots of examples that highlight the gulf between issues that dominate campaign coverage and community concerns, according to Mohamed Ababolgu, starting with the focus on the proposal to access super to help home buyers.
In our community, people work casually and they're not always in employment as well. Building a $50,000 account in your super to use it, as a deposit it's just a joke, really. For an average, taxi driver or Uber driver or even, it's not relevant. If something is not relevant to you, you wouldn't actually react.
For Mohammed and others in this community, there's a consistent theme. engagement should start well before the campaign begins.
The way you build interest in politics or in community and so on is not only at the election time.
That's Mohamed Ababolgu, a member of Melbourne's African community, ending that report from Norman Hermont. Ukraine's first war crimes trial has begun with a Russian soldier pleading guilty to murdering an unarmed civilian. And in another sign the conflict is far from over, the president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has signed decrees to extend martial law for another 90 days, as Catherine Gregory reports.
Ukraine has accused Russian forces of committing more than 10,000 war crimes, and now a 21-year-old Russian soldier is the first to stand trial. Vadim Shishimarin has pleaded guilty to shooting dead a 62-year-old unarmed Ukrainian civilian just days after the invasion began. Outside the court, prosecutor Andrei Siniuk said there's also a witness to the murder.
The indictment was fully announced at the court hearing, and the accused, Shishimarin, fully admitted his guilt in accordance with the circumstances established during the pre-trial investigation and announced by the prosecution during the trial today.
The prosecutor also explains that the soldier was ordered to shoot the elderly Ukrainian man, although the Kremlin says it wasn't informed about the case. The Russian soldier could get life in jail. But his defence lawyer, Viktor Ovsyannikov, says while his client pleaded guilty, it's not as clear-cut as it seems.
He took the guilty plea. He read the indictment and agreed with what was laid out there. But this man, who doesn't understand legal nuances or the rules on qualification of the articles, he can say, yes, that's how it was. But as I said, I have certain objections to what is laid out there.
The trial is hugely symbolic. Ukraine's chief prosecutor tweeted that it sends a message to Russian forces they will be held accountable. Meanwhile, the European Union is speeding up its attempts to abandon any reliance on Russian oil and gas. Ursula von der Leyen is the European Commission president.
We're taking our ambition yet to another level to make sure that we become independent of Russian fossil fuels as quickly as possible. This whole approach is Repower EU. So Repower EU will help us to save more energy, to accelerate the phasing out of fossil fuel, and most importantly, to kickstart investments on a new scale.
Ukraine, meanwhile, is preparing for many more months of fighting. President Volodymyr Zelensky has signed decrees to extend martial law by another 90 days. It means the military can impose curfews and restrict the movement of people, including keeping the ban on men leaving the country so they can stay and fight.
Catherine Gregory. Getting in to see a psychologist has never been harder, and that's being fuelled by a flawed federal funding arrangement, according to the largest professional body representing psychologists in Australia. Universities lose money on postgraduate psychology degrees, so only offer a minimal number of places, thwarting efforts to boost the number of practitioners. And as political reporter Stephanie Dalzell explains, psychologists are calling on the major parties to do more to address the shortfall.
As a top-tier school, Stanford University is one of the most competitive tertiary institutions in the world.
According to one study, if all the companies traced back to Stanford graduates formed their own nation, you'd be one of the largest economies in the world.
But it's easier to study psychology at the US university than here.
It's been such a demoralizing experience trying to get into the program here. I'm looking to apply overseas and kind of look at different countries, Europe and the United States.
By anyone's standards, Nita Rishanzamir is a high achiever. The 25-year-old finished her undergraduate psychology degree 3 years ago with honours and an average of 90% all under her belt. Since then, she's applied multiple times for several master's programs in New South Wales to no avail.
It's just an incredibly frustrating experience. It kind of just, I guess in the midst of a mental health crisis in Australia, it would make sense to admit as many people as possible into the program.
In Australia, you can't become a registered psychologist without a master's degree, but placements are limited. The Commonwealth and students both chip in for their training, but the Australian Psychological Society's Tamara Cavanagh says universities are still losing money.
We're turning away hundreds of students every year
when we could be allowing them to complete their training. And it's just simply because the university, despite the number of applications, isn't increasing places unless the university funding supports that. So if it's going to be an increased loss for them for every student they take on, they're going to take on the bare minimum number of students.
The Australian Psychological Society, which has 27,000 members, is calling on the major parties to increase funding for master's courses, particularly for specialties like child or clinical psychology. Before the pandemic, one in 100 psychologists had closed their books to new patients. Now, it's one in three. The workforce shortages in psychology are acute.
Mental health has become increasingly in demand, and yet we're not seeing that correspond with a number of university places. Yet we're getting these students trained, you know, three quarters of the way. So we're getting them to that fourth year, we're graduating them, and then we're not allowing them to complete their training.
Federal Labor says it's announced additional university places targeted at areas of skills shortage, including within the health sector, while the Coalition says it's investing almost $20 billion in higher education this year after providing for up to 30,000 more uni places overall last year.
Stephanie Dalzell reporting. In the World Heritage listed Daintree rainforest in far north Queensland, trees could once live on average for 80 to 100 years. But the results of a 50-year study show many are now living half as long, and hotter, drier weather is most likely to blame. Annie Guest prepared this report.
The river itself was created by Yarrow. Yarrow is a giant rainbow serpent. So Yarrow comes
Aboriginal guide Juan Walker is showing international journalists the Daintree rainforest north of Cairns.
Well, she went through the eggs she laid all through the river.
He runs his own cultural tourism business. Today he's at Mossman Gorge.
So it's a beautiful rainforest setting, big rainforest trees, two big mountains either side of us with a beautiful freshwater river flowing between the mountains, and the water is running over giant granite boulders, and it's crystal clear fresh water.
How important is the rainforest to Aboriginal people?
Well, to rainforest Aboriginal peoples, it's everything. Supermarket, medicine chest, tool shed, hardware store, and a church all in one.
It's also a place for research, with scientists keeping watch on the growth of 8,000 trees since 1971. Ecologist Professor Susan Lawrence from James Cook University is part of an international team, including scientists from Oxford University, that's followed their lifespan.
Over that almost 50-year period, the number of trees that are dying per year has basically doubled. So what that means is if a stand of trees in North Queensland, on average, the trees age would be 80 to 100, and now that's moved closer towards 50 years.
Professor Lawrence says the most likely cause is warmer temperatures, increasing evaporation, and drying out plants.
Often with our garden, you know that you'll have watered the plants, but you can see, you know, a couple of days later that there can be really quite a lot of wilt on our plants, even though we know the soil is moist. And that wilt is being driven by a combination between air temperature and relative humidity. And it's, we call it vapor pressure deficit.
She warns it'll impede the capacity for tropical ecosystems to survive, avoid fire, and absorb human-caused carbon dioxide emissions. For Aboriginal guide Juan Walker, the findings aren't a surprise.
No, not really. Less rainfall, warmer temperatures, of course. Yeah, the environment can't sustain it. Yeah, it's pretty scary because, like you said, this is my livelihood now, taking people out and showcasing this beautiful place I call home. It's a scary situation.
The scientists say the best chance of promoting tropical rainforest survival is to stabilise global warming to below 2 degrees.
Annie Guest reporting, and the research has been published in Nature. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
It's been an election campaign where Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese have crisscrossed the country, donning hard hats and high visibility safety vests. But how does that resonate with Australian women? Today, the ABC's Annabelle Crabb on why women are increasingly angry at their treatment and how the traditional party system is ignoring them. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.